Good evening, everybody. James McCanna here with my Science Hour. This is for April 25th, 2024. And a couple very interesting and detailed topics I'm going to be covering tonight. One is something called the Artemis Accords. And this is a space-related agreement that a number of nations are participating in. There's a lot of questions revolving around this, and it always amazes me when these agencies, government agencies, get together, and or it could be like the human to Mars thing that's going on. If you haven't heard about that, a lot of people are going to meet and talk about going to Mars, and of course they don't talk about the real issues of getting to Mars and getting people back. It's all pie in the sky stuff. But the Artemis Accords, this is what it amounts to. And here's a quote from the administrator, Mike Gold, Associate Administrator for International and Interagency Relations. And here's what he says. Fundamentally, this is a quote, fundamentally, the Artemis Accords will help avoid conflict in space and on Earth by strengthening mutual understanding and reducing misperceptions. Whoa, this is coming from Never a Straight Answer, NASA. And I'm going to go through the principles of the Artemis Accord, but this, let me do a little bit of backtracking here to history. They reinforce what amounted to in 1967. So this is when I was just starting college. So this is a long time ago, boys and girls. The Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, primarily known as the Outer Space Treaty, and the idea was peaceful use of outer space and cooperation and all kinds of good stuff like that. Well, of course, now we have a Department of the Military, which is called the Space Force. May the Force be with you. Anyway, that's a Trump deal, and it just solidified, because previously it was really ambiguous who had control of outer space. In reality, the Air Force, you would think, had control of outer space, because they have Edwards Air Force Base, of course, where there was a lot of shuttle activity, especially landing. When they came back in, they could come back into Edwards, or they could come across into Florida and land. Okay, and then of course if they landed in Edwards Air Force Base, then they'd have to take the shuttle and put it piggyback on a plane and take it over to the Cape where they would launch, relaunch it. Anyway, one would imagine that the Air Force had control of outer space, but there was a contingency, and of course, whenever anything happens in the military, we have four branches of the military. We have the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marines. And now there's a fifth called the Space Force. So you have these division of labor. And the idea of the Space Force was that we would concentrate all of our space-related activity into one unit. But, you know, it's hard to just make a declaration like that and have it work out. Because really, previously, the Navy, much to, you know, the unbeknownst to most people, the Navy had a major part in outer space. And the rationale for that was because when you're in outer space, you're in a container, basically. You may go out for a spacewalk and go out and turn some nuts and bolts and things like that. But basically, you come back into your space station and you're confined. So the Navy has experience with submarines. These nuclear subs go under the water, and they'll be out for 6 months or, you know, better part of a year underwater. And these guys, they don't see the light of day. And it's nuclear powered, and those things can sit down there and they can recycle the air and everything else. But the Navy had the wherewithal to do this kind of thing. Plus, the Navy had probably as much air power as the Air Force. If you consider what the Air Force had, you know, the big stuff, the B-52s and the B-2 bombers and stuff don't land on aircraft carriers. But when it comes to operations and jet activity, the Navy was the one who had much of the function of doing things in the air with jet planes. And of course, Miramar was the training center, the famous movies Top Gun with Tom Cruise, centered around the activity in Miramar, where they were flying back in the original Top Gun movie. It was F-14s, and then it was, the recent, more recent one. But at any rate, it's the Navy who had really control of the air, because you can move these aircraft carriers near something, and your high-performance jet planes can get out there and do a job, surveillance or chasing down the enemy or whatever, chasing down naval vessels, tracking, all kinds of things. And then, but here's was an interesting thing that happened. This was back in the, it may have been 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I don't even remember. But the Navy came out with its budget, and $60 billion in aerospace procurement for the Navy. That's at the time was about well over three times the entire NASA budget for all of NASA. That includes all the employees, everything. And this was for procurement. That means buying hardware and software or other physical things for the Navy. Then this was the Navy's budget. So lots and lots of stuff going on, black ops. And, being a person who has been around rubbing elbows with tier one scientists, I know that they have a lot going on. And I knew some of the programs because I designed some of them. So anyway, the Navy had a big hand in this, and then to a lesser degree, the Army and the Marines, because they were more land-based. And of course, the Marines were hand in hand with the Navy, because they had the ships, the Navy had the ships to bring the Marines to where they were going. So they worked hand in hand. And then also the Army, because the Army had need for moving troops, moving equipment. And what do you have? You have the Navy with ships capable of moving stuff. Okay. So anyway, that's a little bit of history. So 1967, the Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space. That's a mouthful. And so this is this armistice, the, not armistice, excuse me, I'm going to pronounce it correctly. Artemis. Interestingly enough, this is the same name as the NASA manned Moon and Mars mission, Artemis. And this is the Artemis mission is the pre-landing program to test equipment and understand outer space to the point where they can go to the moon and be successful. It's the Artemis mission. So I'm kind of scratching my head why the association. I mean, these agencies are very good at coming up with names. They can use Greek names. Every planet and minor planet and Kuiper Belt object has a some kind of Latin or Greek name associated, mythological name associated with it. So why are they using the same name for the Artemis mission, which is a pre-lunar landing mission to understand, what it takes to get to the moon again, versus deep space accords with other nations? Now, let me just go through the nations who have already signed this. So we see a lot of, England-related countries. So we have Australia, Canada, Italy, Japan, Luxembourg, United Arab Emirates, United Kingdom, and the United States. So you find you have Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom, all kind of, you might say they're one and the same, even though Canada and Australia are allegedly different countries. They come under the umbrella of the United Kingdom. Then you have the United Arab Emirates, and I wouldn't call them a major superpower in outer space, nor Luxembourg. Japan, somewhat. Italy, a little bit, part of the European Union. And then United States, of course, and NASA is the big kid on the block when it comes to spending money and getting, everybody wants to work with NASA because they They have the money, they have the good equipment, they have the launch pads, and if you're not working with them, you're not in the game. But when you look at that list, there are a few characters that are conspicuously missing. One would be China, and another one would be Russia. Now, one could speculate a lot as to what's going on there. What's the real reason why those countries are not involved in this accord? It could be because there's some a very high-level tension between these countries today. China, and of course, the United States just sent what? Billions of dollars, $10 billion, I'm not sure how much, to Taiwan, Taiwan, not, yeah, Taiwan. And of course, that's like a thumb in the eye of China. And then, of course, Ukraine just got another, I don't know, what, couple hundred Bs, billions. And so, anyway, Russia and China are not in this accord. But does that mean they don't want peaceful activity in outer space? Well, they're probably going to keep their technology and what they're doing to themselves. So let me go through what this accord is all about. And I'll quickly read these, and then I'll go through them one by one. But when you hear these, okay, the first one, of course, is peaceful explorations, that all activities conducted under the Artemis program with all these nations must be for peaceful purposes. So that would mean that everybody's out there, they're not developing military, but on the side, of course, NASA doesn't develop, allegedly doesn't develop military items. But what if they discover something interesting in outer space that could then be used for military weapons, and that technology gets moved over to the military? And of course, the first thing the military's going to do is convert it into some kind of military weapon. I know that. Anyway, I'm not going to go down that road right now. The second item, transparency, that signatories, everybody signing, will conduct their activities in a transparent fashion to avoid confusion and conflicts. Now, that's okay, I'll talk about that. Emergency assistance. Well, this makes sense. If somebody is in distress out there, that anybody can lend a helping hand to, save the people or bring them back or get them back down to Earth safely or whatever. So emergency assistance, that sounds like a good thing. If I were up in space, and the Italians or the Australians had the ability to pick me up and bring me back home in one piece, okay, go for it. Registration of space objects. Now this gets interesting. This once again is coming from NASA, mind you, who hardly complied with this in the past, even with our own nations, to understand what they're putting where. And this begs the question, because we have a Tier 1 space program, which is unseen by the public, registration of space objects. So the Artemis signatories are to have a registration convention, and register all the equipment and everything they're doing. Well, that's nice, but the reality is, with the Space Force and military, they're not going to do that. So this is the touchy-feely side of, the public side of NASA, which I always remind you is Tier 2 science. Okay, this is the one I'm going to talk about the most, the release of scientific data. Okay, I'm going to read this. Artemis Accords signatories commit to the public release of scientific information, allowing the whole world to join us on the Artemis journey. Now, NASA never did this. When I was at Cornell, I had access to NASA data because they didn't really realize I was there, and I would take the data and the information that was available, and then basically verifying my theoretical work and then publishing it with my results showing that just about everything NASA was doing was wrong. So they shut it down. And so when I would go to get data, they would basically say that, first of all, they came back and they said, well, the principal investigators on the principal investigators, the PIs on the project, would have 30 days with the data, first of all. And then 30 days would go by, and I'd go back and I'd say, okay, where's the data? And I want the original data. I want the raw data, not the modified, blended, homogenized, pasteurized, and blended data that would come off of the PIs with their interpretation. No, I wanted the raw data. And of course, that didn't happen. So then the 3 months went to 6 months, and the 6 months went to a year. And it was just like the, in fact, I made discoveries that were made public in the scientific community. And they even got to the point where they said, only the PIs can make discoveries. You are not, as a non-PI, allowed to make discoveries with our data. So I'll talk a little more about that one. Preserving heritage. Oh boy, Artemis Accord signatories commit to preserving outer space heritage. Here we're talking about NASA, who destroyed all of the data, all of the logs, all of the records, all of the footage, all of the camera footage, all of the video footage of the Apollo program, all of the equipment, all of everything, anything that had to do with the Apollo program was purposefully destroyed. So now, in the Accord, the Artemis Accord, the release of scientific data. I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. The next one, preserving heritage. Oh no, I'm sorry, that's what I just read. Yeah, space resources. Extracting and utilizing space resources is key to safe and sustainable exploration. Wow, they got the sustainable word in there. And the Artemis Accord signatories affirm that such activities should be conducted in compliance with the Outer Space Treaty. Now, here we go. This is interesting. But and now you got people like private corporations like Elon Musk, SpaceX. Do they sign on to this? No. And this brings up a very interesting point. Does NASA have, authority? Do they have the ability? Do they have the, they're an agency with, they're signing on to something here. Do they have jurisdiction? That's the correct word. I was kind of hunting for it there, but do they have jurisdiction over the ability to sign and to sign over space resources? Very interesting. Interesting question. I can't. Having a hard time talking this evening. Okay. Deconfliction of activities. Okay. This is the next point. Commit to prevent harmful interference and supporting the principle of due regard as required by the Outer Space Treaty. So this goes back, some of these are going back to the original treaty. And so somebody's going out into space, trying to get someplace, trying to accomplish something, and then somebody on the other side goes, well, we don't want you doing that. We don't want you going there. And so they sabotage missions. Now, let me tell you, I've talked about this in my show, the Burt Rutan space, the X Prize that they were working on had a number of little accidents. And then even after the X Prize, there was another accident which prevented them from moving along. And there have been these things that kind of turned up. Let me give another example. A number of countries have tried to get to Mars, and they just never quite can get there. Let's talk about the private enterprises, the private companies that are trying to get to the moon and have soft landings. And doggone it, when they get right up there to land, they have all kinds of problems. So, would NASA sign on to this when they're not really complying with this right now? And remember that NASA is controlled by the CIA, who does a lot of dirty work on an international basis. Are the Mars rovers, those little things rolling around up there in Mars and sending pictures back. Are those really the only thing up there? No, I guarantee you that not NASA, but Tier 1 science has Mars rovers that'll knock your socks off and flying around Mars and doing excavation and archaeology, etc. Yes. Okay, and here's the last one, orbital debris. The countries commit to planning for the safe disposal of debris. Now, nobody has dumped more crap into space than NASA over the decades. And it just, you know, how many tens, hundreds of thousands of nuts and bolts and shrouds and everything else, doors and, spent rocket engines are floating around in outer space out there. You know, just tons of stuff. And they actually keep track of it. There are people who that's their job. It's agencies that they keep track of all of this stuff. And eventually we're going to have to go up and clean that up, all of that stuff. And there are programs, people actually looking at different ways of accumulating that. But it's a huge problem because this stuff is in all kinds of different orbits. If it was all in one orbit, that would make it a little bit easier. But space is a big, big, big place. And let's make an analogy here. Let's go back to the old square rig sailing days in the Middle Ages, the 1500s, the 1600s, when the big ships were out on the ocean. You know, and they were throwing junk overboard, but it was mainly wooden and things that would decompose. Maybe some lead cannonballs or something, but really not much. But imagine all the stuff that they threw overboard out in the middle of the ocean, and imagine somebody then would have to go out, and this is in a two-dimensional surface, to go out and recuperate all of that stuff that they had tossed overboard. And that's on a two-dimensional surface, and I mean, it's literally an impossible task. Or take modern cruise liners that are dumping garbage into the ocean on a daily basis. And even at that, the vast amounts that are being dumped into the oceans would be very difficult to recuperate, to go out and find it and get it back and get it back out of the water. So space is very much more difficult because once you're in orbit, say you have a thing that can collect space debris. You invented some kind of big net or some kind of electromagnetic thing or something to collect space junk. And so you get out, you're in orbit. Now to get to where the junk is in all these different orbits, you have to change orbits. One of the most difficult things to do in outer space. A lot of energy and really very difficult to do. And so even if you could get out there, it's the three-dimensional aspect of outer space because this junk is all the way out to geosynchronous orbit. It's everywhere. It's in low Earth orbit. It's, in every imaginable orbit. And, you know, to try and do this in three dimensions where in a two-dimensional scenario, like with the boats, etc., would be absolutely impossible in two dimensions. Three dimensions, forget it. I mean, and maybe some people will go out there and make a stab at this, but it's a insurmountable problem. It's like one time I gave a lecture on this show about getting rid of nuclear waste. And if you look at the amount of nuclear waste that's been the spent nuclear waste that's sitting around nuclear power plants and in other locations, mainly around the power plants because they don't know where to put it. And to some people suggested, oh, why don't we just blast it off into space and send it off to the sun? And I went through the calculations of what it would take to do that, the number of launches, and it turns out that all the launches that have ever been made in the history of the space program would not even make a dent in getting the spent nuclear materials off into space. And then what would happen if you had an accident, like you had the old shuttle blowing up type of accident with the load of nuclear spent fuel going up into space, and that comes down, hits the ocean, and then it contaminates a vast stretch of the ocean. This is really mean stuff that they have. Like Chernobyl, what a mess. What an absolute mess. Anybody that thinks that nuclear energy is green, you got to get your head examined. My particular advanced degree, nuclear solid state physics, is, nuclear physics. I happen to know a little bit about it. But what you find is the majority of people that have degrees in nuclear physics are rah-rah nuclear. It's like, for them, the best thing since sliced bread. Okay, so back to this list now. Let me go through this list a little bit slower and talk about these items one by one. Okay, so peaceful exploration. And remember that the undertone here is, does NASA have jurisdiction to sign some kind of international accord? And where did they get that jurisdiction? Their operational modus operandi is to go into space. I really don't know what their edict is. What is their, they have some pie in the sky things like to help man, one step for mankind, whatever. But they really don't have, to do something like this, they would need a special, literally regulation, like voting from Congress. And, the federal government is limited to the powers that were given to it in the Constitution. So when you talk about, regulating or negotiating a contract or agreements for outer space, it's not in the cards. And I've talked about this before extensively. Of course, I talk about this all the time, that they do, who has control of the of airspace? I just talked about I think it was last week's show. I talked about the Tennessee issue and the fact that they're talking about preventing chemtrails. Okay, very good. But who has jurisdiction? Does the state of Tennessee? Is it a federal thing? Does the FAA have? Well, how about the Environmental Pollution Agency? How about, I've talked about this before, but a teaching technique is sometimes to repeat things so that it sticks. When I used to teach in the university level, I said, if there's a point that I really want to make, I have to repeat it three times. And sometimes people go, well, you repeated that one. So, then you heard it the first two times. 60% of the people out there are hearing it for the first time, even though it's the third time. So excuse me if I'm a bit repetitive sometimes. But, okay, peaceful exploration. All activities conducted must be for peaceful purposes. Okay, let's break this down. Let's look at things in the past. The space shuttle. The space shuttle was used for military purposes. It was a way of getting into space. It was the United States' only way to get into space. Let's talk about, say, the delivery of the Hubble Space Telescope. That was done by the space shuttle back in the 80s. And then, remember, it got up there and they had the mirrors ground completely incorrectly, so they had to go back up and because it was out of focus. But anyway, I guarantee you that the military used that telescope for military purposes. And so anyway, the idea that everything is going to be done for peaceful purposes simply is not correct. If there's a technology developed that could, say, be more efficient at mining asteroids, let's say, okay, sounds pretty peaceful to me, but who owns that facility? Is this going to be shared with the entire world if they hit a pocket of platinum? And it's you know it's 10 times the amount of platinum that currently exists on planet Earth. That alone could come back and change the entire economy of the world. Do you think those people are going to say, "Oh, well, this is for everybody"? This is another point. When they talk about everybody, peaceful purposes, they ain't talking about you, buddy, who gets up in the morning, goes to work, pays your taxes, insurance, house payment, everything else. No, they ain't talking about you. In fact, this is very clear to me. The entire purpose of NASA is to keep you from getting into space. Everything that's happened, including the accidents or the so-called accidents, I don't believe they were accidents. You know, that a teacher was killed or allegedly killed, we don't even know. There's no proof other than NASA telling us that seven people died in a space shuttle accident when it blew up on the way up to, to launch. And of course the message, whether it was what had happened, whether it was real, whether it was false flag, whether it was fixed, whatever, the end result is that every student, grade school, high school, university, for years they were looking for the teacher in space candidate. And all the kids in grade school and high school wrote for their science teacher why Mr. Jones or Mrs. Appleby should be our teacher in space. And they finally get it down to, what, Cindy McCullough, what's her name? Anyway, the teacher in space. And they go to launch day, and everybody's there, and invited guests, and everything else. And the thing launches, and right in plain view of everybody, blows up, including the parents, etc. And, was anybody on that flight? I don't know. Supposedly there were. But you got to take NASA's word for this. This is never a straight answer. So anyway, the whole idea sounds just, rosy glasses, peaceful purposes in space. But then, as I said, this does not include the military. We have the Space Force, which is specifically designed for military operations in space. And I guarantee you, their mission overrides any peaceful purposes that NASA might designate. So there's this division of labor, and how can NASA sign a contract saying that everything that's going to happen from the United States? And so this is the myth. They're propagating a myth that simply cannot happen. Okay. Transparency. There again, I guarantee you this is human nature. Somebody goes out and discovers something. My work is on comets, the electrical nature of comets in the solar system and everything else. I've talked about a guy named Dan Golden back in the day. This is back in the, oh, in the 90s when he was the head of NASA. He came in under, actually under Clinton. He was designated by George Bush Sr., who handed the baton off to Billy Clinton, and who comes in to run NASA but Dan Golden from the CIA. That's when the CIA really put the lid on NASA. They controlled it before, but not to the level that occurred. And that was at the time when Harrington discovered Hale-Bopp. I talk about this in my book, The Real History of Planet X, Update 2020. So go read that book for all the details. But the idea of transparency, that somehow there's openness, no. NASA, make no mistake about it, is controlled by the CIA. And the CIA is the police force of the World Bank. So what their goal is, what their charter is in secret, is to keep you from going into outer space, you, the John Q. public. And so the idea that all of the information is going to be available to the public. And this ties in with a couple other things like release of scientific data. I'll get into that again in a minute. But transparency, this is like goody two shoes, goody gumdrop, pie in the sky. Isn't space wonderful? We're all going to go to Mars and walk around with our little backpacks. But the reality is, once somebody finds something. Say, there again, good example is mining asteroids. There are, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of chunks of stuff out there in the asteroid belt, zipping around the sun in all kinds of different orbits, and some of them are going to have the mother load of gold or iron or silver or maybe number of these things, platinum, metals, or other things that are useful, aluminum, that are useful in outer space manufacturing. And so if somebody comes across something, I guarantee you, they are going to keep that information private so that their country can go out and score. And I mean, this is, let's go back to the Middle Ages, the 1500s, the post-Middle Ages, Age of Exploration, let's call it, the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, where these countries, you know, you have France, you have Italy, you have the Low Countries, the Netherlands, you have the Scandinavian countries, you have Europe, which is England, of course, big naval power, Spain, Portugal, and vying for riches around the world. Once they got so they could travel around the world, you know, Magellan had made his circumglobe voyage. And Vasco da Gama moving around south of Africa, establishing the sea route to India to avoid because they established the trade routes by camel and horseback going across the spice route and the silk route, but it was dangerous. And so they had to then beef up their defenses just to make that passage because, of course, as soon as they started moving these rich, valuable products, gee, guess what? Right through the Middle East, there were bands of people that were just waiting there to steal it, kill them all and steal it. So it was dangerous. It wasn't an easy thing. And so, you know, to find a sea route where you could just, you know, you had to deal with the ocean and all the perils and everything else dealing with the ocean, but you didn't have this constant being attacked by raiders, you know, highwaymen or whatever you want to call them. There again, if somebody finds a method, like I say, for mining asteroids or finds an asteroid with a lot of minerals in it, this Artemis Accord is for deep space. And that's kind of an interesting thing, too, because, you know, the original searches will be to the moon. That's the closest thing. And then Mars. And so why are they talking about deep space in this? It's rather confusing to me. Why would they talk about deep space? Why not all of space? Or why not low Earth orbit? They don't include those. They don't include those because that's where the big money is right now. But, it was like another thing, just like the old square rigger days when the Spanish and the Portuguese and the English were building bigger and bigger ships to carry more and more stuff back from the New World, you know, including slaves, including goods, including spices, all kinds of things, gold. Riches beyond anybody's wildest imaginations had been accumulated by the Incas and the Aztecs, and it was there for the taking. So don't tell me that this is going to be transparent, because human nature is human nature. As soon as somebody finds out there is something out there, a technique or something like that, it's going to be held secret by a country, and then we have all of these there's alliances, and then there are alliances that come and go. And so we tend to be more aligned with Europe and England, but there's a lot of infighting, etc. Okay, interoperability. I could start this out by talking about the Chinese. The Chinese waited a long time to get into the space program and to start. And what happened is they made their move at the time when the USSR was disbanding. And so the space program, the fledgling space program of Russia, the United Russia, they were out of money. So to keep moving, to get some money so they could keep their operation moving, they sold technology to China at pennies on the dollar, literally. And so the Chinese came in and bought the docking mechanisms and the technology on how to dock. It's not just the docking mechanism, how to get two spacecraft to meet and seal, airtight seal, so that then people can move from one to the other. Not only that, but the orbital techniques. How do you move these spacecraft that are in different orbits, and to get them to get to the point where they can merge and become one spacecraft? To it's called docking. And so the interoperability is very important because you need technology that works together. So the Chinese bought the rocket technology, the engines, the docking mechanisms, the technology for building tanks that hold high pressure gases like oxygen needed for the astronauts, the guidance systems for sending things, say, to the moon. Anyway, just all of this technology, and it was all it had interoperability. Now, the International Space Station, the thing there is you had to have standards so that the Russian equipment could dock, the American equipment could dock, etc. So interoperability, there again, and that's important too for the next point. And that's something that I think is achievable. And that's good. Just like automobiles, when you go, whether you buy a car from Japan or a car from the United States, European car, you go to the gas station, you put the hose in to fill it up with gas. Or now, if you have electric vehicles, or even now in upcoming hydrogen, you go up to fill it up, you open up the little door, and that nozzle is standardized, so it fits into the receptacle in your car. So interoperability is very important, for many reasons. So these standards are developed to make it easy for everybody, and then it makes it easy for everybody to compete. But now here's the thing, and it's very subtle. They're going to have interoperability standards for the people who signed up, and those are the government agencies. That, once again, it's not you. If you went to NASA and says, "I want to build a spacecraft, and I want to build it, so it's interoperable with the docking mechanism or the engine systems or something," they're gonna tell you to take a hike. You aren't included, buddy, nor is your private company. But if you get a contract with the government and you're doing something relative to the government, okay, now you're going to have access because you're playing in their ballpark. But for you to go in and get interoperability designs as a private enterprise, as a person that wants to build, say, a private space program, you're not going to be in the clubhouse. So, all of this stuff, and to the unaided eye, a person that's has the rose-colored glasses on, this all looks just wonderful. Okay, just quickly, emergency assistance, the idea that rendering assistance for persons in distress. Okay, you really can't argue with that. But there again, if I'm a private enterprise out in outer space, and let's go back to the days of the square sails. There was a group of people called privateers, and these were rich guys that owned a big boat or maybe a whole fleet of boats, and they would do private bidding, and the ocean was like the wild, wild west. If you could board a ship and take it, it was yours. There was nobody there. If they couldn't defend themselves, then you were you were in trouble out on the open ocean. But there developed privateers. Captain Morgan used to hang out down in the Caribbean, and they were pirates. basically they robbed people, but it turned out that England allowed Captain Morgan to rob other ships because they said, okay, you can rob the French, you can rob the Spanish, and we'll let you survive. We won't do anything to you because you're robbing our enemies, basically. And there's a perfect example of exactly what I'm talking about here. The nations that were involved in plundering the New World, basically were at war with each other. And the same thing with outer space. So these countries are signing this agreement. But most of these countries, look at them, they're in terms of their space program, Australia, Canada, even England, you know, is a nothing burger when it comes to outer space. They have a fledgling space program. So it's to their benefit to sign on to be buddies with NASA. Okay. So anyway, emergency assistance, yeah, that's a good deal. But there again, to have the equipment, say somebody's lost in a spacecraft out in outer space, well, you have to have the ability to dock with that spacecraft to get the people back and forth. And so that would be the interoperability thing. And, you know, for a private company to come along and do all of this development and develop completely independently is be very difficult. You see SpaceX, but you got to remember that SpaceX got $2 billion with a B when they settled the lawsuit. They were suing the government. And this is very, very interesting. Very backdoor. So SpaceX was not getting contracts. This is back in the early SpaceX days. They have rockets. They're trying to get launch contracts, but they can't get them away from the big aerospace companies that have been just sitting back, smoking a big cigar, sitting on their laurels, and getting all of these space contracts. So they continue to do that. And Musk comes up and says, hey, I'm capable of doing this. In fact, I can do a better job, cheaper, but I'm not getting the contracts. So he sues the government, and it's going to go to court, and they settle out of court. And the day he settles, he gets $2 billion. It was an investment from Google and Fidelity that, you know, are both CIA front agencies with drug money. So Elon Musk gets $2 billion. Just dumped into his company as an investment when he settles. And of course, the flip side of that is he's got to be one of the boys. He's got to ride herd with the with NASA. So, you know, a lot of his success in SpaceX is not because he built a company that was totally independent. No. He very much had huge amounts of support. I'd sure like a business that got two B's dumped into my bank account on a given day. Wow. Okay. So registration of outer space objects. Okay, it says any nation participating must be a signatory to the registration convention to become a signatory with alacrity. Okay, so what does that mean? Alacrity means like do it right now, like pronto. If you find something in outer space, you have to register it right away. It has to become part of the common database. You can't hold this thing secret. Okay, so there again, if something big hits, let's say you're out there, you're Australia, and you send up the first rocket, and you're doing you get beyond the Van Allen belts with just some kind of mission, unmanned mission. And you go out there. And remember, all of this stuff here is this Artemis Accord is dealing with a lot of manned space things. They're talking about emergency helping, you know, save people. But remember that a lot of the smaller companies will be doing like little cube satellites or little cube probes or small technology that will allow them to, you know, very light, small payloads, as opposed to the big ones that NASA always built. This again goes back to the Middle Ages or the years of exploration. with the square rig sail ships is that if somebody found something, you know, the buried treasure, the keeping things hidden, etc., it's going to happen. Believe me, if somebody discovers something, they're going to go, whoa, okay, we're just going to keep this private. Let's take a good example. Large comets develop diamonds in front of the comet in the electric current that is part of the discharge. And as one of my main discoveries also is one of the side effects is basically natural manufacturing process for diamonds. And this is how diamonds are actually made in the laboratory also, is you take carbon, vaporize it into an atomic form, basically, send in an electron stream, and the carbon forms the basically a buckyball type of superstructure, and then inside of that is where the diamonds form. And some of these diamonds can be big, so it would be a real, you know, a very pure diamonds, because they're not under stress, they're not under atmospheric conditions, so you could potentially have super pure diamonds and lots of them in the nose side of the comet, not just x-rays but diamonds. So what if somebody comes back with a load of diamonds and says, oh yeah, I just happened to find them over here, new, you know, reserve on Earth or something, and not proclaim it? So do you really think that resources, now this comes back to the military, if the U.S. military goes out and they're doing deep space exploration and they come across some major find of minerals or metals or whatever, they're not bound by this contract, even though they're part of the United States. And this gets back to my point, does NASA have jurisdiction to do this? And to what extent? Who does it cover? Does it cover private companies? Does it cover SpaceX? Does it cover, you know, the 100 other companies that are out there doing space work? I mean, you know, does NASA have jurisdiction to, if these companies are private and they've never done work with NASA or taken government contracts, are they somehow bound by this? No. NASA doesn't have jurisdiction to sign over private corporation rights and privileges. Okay, so anyway, you can see this thing is so full of holes like Swiss cheese. Okay, I'm going to pick up the pace here a little bit. Release of scientific data. Oh my goodness, I guarantee you this is not going to happen. And what they're going to do is reserve it for the principal investigator. So the signature that you would release scientific data is to the group countries, and probably on a release basis, like the principal investigators are going to get the first 6 months with the data, and then they only have to release the homogenized, blended, purified data that would be then passed on to somebody else along with the interpretation. And so that's where NASA really breaks down, is with scientific interpretation of data. And that's what keeps these groups, these power groups, like the Big Bang and the microwave background radiation or general relativity, that's what keeps these groups in power, is because they have the ability to withhold data. Neil deGrasse Tyson, in a video when he was promoting his, channel, it's like Masterclass. When he was promoting that, he says, one of his arguments is that NASA has all his data, you're some individual out there, like implying like me or somebody else, and you don't have the data, we have the data, so we're the ones in charge of the data, and we're the only ones that can interpret that. And I proved that wrong when I was at Cornell, and boy, they did not like that. They really, really don't like somebody coming in and taking their data and telling them what it means. So this is a ruse, release of scientific data. That's all I can tell you. And they're not going to abide by it, and it's only going to be within their parameters. Preserving heritage. Oh, okay. I already mentioned the NASA Apollo program and a lot of other programs like the Voyager programs, the visiting the outer planets with the Voyager program. Good grief. The data is first homogenized and blended, then it's published in like Science or Nature magazine, and that's the end of it. That's where it ends. And that's considered the knowledge that is then passed off to you, the public. And I guarantee you, they were hiding data. They were things that were data that was available. Okay, I'm going to have to quickly go through these last. Preserving heritage. Did NASA's purposefully destroyed all of the everything related to the Apollo space program? Everything, all records, everything. So, do what I say, not what I do. Okay, space resources, to be in compliance, sustainable exploration, all of this stuff. Nice words, but not really. What does it really mean? Deconfliction of activities, preventing harmful interference and supporting the principle of due regard, like be nice to your neighbor. Okay. In other words, don't sabotage other people's projects. And then orbital debris. You know, there's nobody that's dumped more crap into space than NASA. Okay, I've got about 2 minutes left here. I just want to give a quick mention. The sale that's on the MR5 water filters is ending. It'll be tomorrow night. Finally take that down. It was a few people asked me to keep it up, but it's literally $1,000 off. It's called the best deal package with the MR5 whole house water filter and the UV sterilizer. That package $1,250 and typically $1,000 more than that. And then also the gravity filters, so that's always a constant seller on the web page. We never put them on sale because they're already a super, super price. So visit the web pages jmccwaterfilters.com and the new updated page, the main page, which you can get to all the other sub pages, jmccsci.com. Okay, I want to spend the last minute here talking about peer review. And the is this idea that all of knowledge is contained within peer review, and I would say that probably about 80% of it is useless or worthless or just simply incorrect. And finally, people in that world are waking up to that fact. So anyway, luckily there are some agencies out there that allow printing of publications that do not require peer review, because the other thing peer review does is block people like myself from publishing, because I don't put up with peer review, somebody reviewing my material. How absurd. Once again, James McCanney here. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.